Hello, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing great as well. It feels like we have somewhat of a spring weather here today, which means, of course, it's still very much winter, but the sun has shown itself, which I'm very, very happy about. So I'm feeling energized and excited to record Stack Trace with you.
Awesome. Yeah, weather has been great here as well, but different season, right? We spoke about
that. Yeah, I was going to say, big surprise that the weather has been great in Brazil.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to lately? I know that you just came home from a trip to Europe, which I definitely want to talk to you about later. Maybe it's even going to be a bit of a hidden chapter here at the end of this episode. Who will know? Who will see, right? But yeah. In terms of your work and you know, what you've been coding on and things like that, what have you been up to?
So I've been working on adding support for new devices in everybody, which is a theme we've talked about before, but I think this is interesting because this time I'm working on adding support for a brand new class of devices.
And would you say that it's a class of devices that I might be into in particular?
More than myself, definitely. And for those who don't follow me on Mastodon, mastodon.social/_inside, and who don't know the differences between our tastes, I'm talking about game controllers.
All right. Yeah, that is definitely kind of more my thing than yours. But in this aspect of game controllers is definitely more your thing because, you know, following what you've been working on and talking to you a little bit as well behind the scenes here, it's really, really interesting for me, the work you've been doing in being able to communicate with these game controllers over Bluetooth through AirBuddy. So I really, really want to hear a lot about this, like the technical details and what it's been like to work on this feature. But perhaps before we start diving into those aspects, like all the fun technical details, why are you doing this? Like, what is the kind of motivation to add this feature to AirBuddy?
It's a feature that's been requested quite a lot by users, and it is requested with a certain frequency. So every now and then I'll get someone asking for this feature, and it always gets me because I don't see the Mac as a big like game playing machine, and we spoke about that at length in other episodes, but apparently some people really like using game controllers on their Macs, and they would like to get that information available in AirBuddy. And in this case, it's a bit of a special situation because my policy with AirBuddy has always been I will support anything that macOS itself supports. That's why for you to get information about third-party headsets not made by Apple, so like if you have a Sony headphones or something like that, it requires macOS Monterey because that's when Apple added support for it. And I just piggyback on the support that the operating system offers. But for game controllers, macOS supports them in the sense that you can use them to control games and you can like press the, well, whatever the home button is on the game controller, and it opens up a launchpad with the games category pre-selected, which I think it's pretty cool. But in terms of actual like reporting battery levels and charging state and things like that, macOS doesn't really bother with that, at least not for most popular game controllers that they support, and also not in a reliable way.
Right. And this is actually like, I think, a really important aspect because, you know, as someone who plays a lot of games, there has been many times where I've been, you know, in an intense boss fight in a game or something, and then my controller just dies. In fact, that actually happened to me like 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And I am, of course, hoping that one day in the future you will also port AirBuddy to Windows, which I don't think will happen because, you know, then I can use it on my gaming PC. Because that actually did happen when I was connected with my Xbox controller to my gaming PC, where I'm sure I can install some kind of program or plugin or something similar to what AirBuddy now will do that will tell me the battery level in a more reliable way and will give me notifications when the battery is running low, because most consoles do that. Like when I have my Xbox controller connected to my Xbox, it will tell me like the battery's running low, the battery's running low. But of course, then you're always thinking, ah, I'll charge it tomorrow, I'll charge it tomorrow. And then eventually you're still in that situation where you have low battery. But either way, like that is a really, really useful feature to have for game controllers specifically. And great that you're like working on that. Are you also going to do some kind of notification system when you are running low on battery? Because I do believe you have that for other devices, right?
Yes, I do, and this is an interesting aspect that maybe we can talk about a bit more when I talk about the specifics of the implementation, but I don't really have to do any special handling in order for that system to work with these devices. Basically, it's at a level of abstraction where it doesn't really matter what the device is. The app just has the information about whether it has a battery or not, and if it has a battery, it will let you create a battery alert for it. And there is a remote configuration I have, because some devices maybe it doesn't make sense for you to be able to set a charged alert, because the app can't receive information when the device is actively charging. For example, like older models of AirPods, most of them, that doesn't really make sense, because when they're charging in the charging case, the app doesn't know about them, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, it will support battery alerts. Although there might be some quirks I'll have to handle, because there's a thing about the way battery reporting works. At least so far, I've worked with the Sony DualSense controller, so the PS5 controller. And also I've worked with, I'm currently actively working on the Joy-Con for the Nintendo Switch. And both of them, they don't report battery levels like I'm used to with AirPods. They report battery levels in like ranges. So basically like I'm full, I'm kind of full, I'm like kind of low, or I'm dead. That's like
nice.
The extent. So there's like, there's not much precision, which is interesting. Like it makes sense for you to think, oh, these are embedded devices, so they have to simplify things, but it's one byte. Like, with one byte, you can represent battery levels up to 100% and then some, and you can use the extra bits to represent special states, which is how Apple does it for AirPods. So you can get the full 0 to 100% charge levels for a battery and the charging state with a single byte. So I don't know why they are so crazy about saving space, because in the HID report, so the data that comes over HID, which is the protocol that's used, they do use a full byte for the battery information. So I don't know if the battery chemistry doesn't allow them to get very precise information, or maybe the power controller they use is not as precise. So yeah, it's just interesting. So that means that at least for the DualSense, I think the resolution, let's call it that, is like 10%. So from 90, it goes to 100, and goes to 80, 70, and so on. So it's just a quirk that I'll have to work with somehow for the battery alerts, because if someone sets a battery alert for 55%, like that doesn't make much sense for something that only reports every 10%.
Yeah, maybe you need to kind of carry over that resolution data to that UI, right? So that when you're adding a battery alert for a device that you know only has a lower percentage in terms of resolution, then you also have the UI update to so that you can only set it to those kind of different increments of that resolution that it supports. And I'm thinking that perhaps the reason like that it works this way is just a simple explanation of that's what they needed when they built the UI for the consoles. Because yeah. I don't have a PS5, so I don't know exactly how it looks like that when you're opening, you know, the controller menu and see how much battery you have left for your controller. But on the Nintendo Switch, I do know that you, for example, you connect your Pro Controller or something, it only shows this little bar that is very, very small that doesn't show you the exact percentage, as far as I know, at least. Like, it only shows you a little bar that shows you the level of battery that is left. And perhaps, you know, when they were engineering that system, they just thought, well, it's enough to just report every 10% because we don't show more precise aspects of that in the UI anyway.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And perhaps it would be best if I actually, this is me designing my app live on a podcast, but perhaps I should introduce a new concept of some devices don't show a percentage, basically, because I think you're right in the sense that they implemented what they needed for the way they represent battery level, which I don't use the PlayStation that much, but I don't think they ever actually show a number. They only show like an icon, so like a little progress.
Yeah, like a classic little battery icon that is filling up, right? Depending on how much charge you have left.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe I should do that because it's not just game controllers. There are a few other devices that will show up in AirBuddy where a percentage is not going to be precise. For example, if you have older versions of Apple's Magic Mouse and Keyboard, they use external batteries, so the AA batteries, those also won't be very precise because they are not like lithium batteries with intelligence that can precisely report their level. Also, if I ever support AirTag, I think it only reports like 3 levels of battery charge capacity, which is enough because like it lasts like a year, so you don't need to know exactly if it's a 99% or if it's a 1%. So yeah, maybe I'll do something about that. The problem though is I know, like, I will introduce this feature because so many people want it, and after I do that, if I decide to go that route, the next feature that everyone will ask, why don't you show percentage? I want to see the battery percentage.
Maybe you can have like some tooltip in the UI for that. Like, I don't know, you probably don't want to put like info buttons everywhere that you can click to see like an explanation as to why it works this way. But perhaps it could be like the first time you show a game controller, you could show like a little tooltip that says, you know, for this device, you can see the approximate battery level or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. Also, and this is a tangent, but I've been thinking a lot about the onboarding experience for the app and also the fact that many people request either a trial or like a demo version of the app because they just want to test to see if their device works with AirBuddy. So right. I am thinking about some changes to the onboarding experience where you can launch the app and even if you don't have a license or anything, the first step in the onboarding will be, hey, here are all of your devices that I've recognized and you can like debug your own devices before you even buy the app. So that if you are unsure about getting the app because maybe it won't support your device, then you can do that test beforehand. And also that would be a great place to add those advisories like, hey, you have this PlayStation controller, FYI, I won't be able to show you precise percentage, but you will get information. So yeah, I think it all kind of ties together in a sense. And I already have a system in place where I basically have a database. It's actually a proper list file, don't tell anyone. But I have a database in the app and I can update it remotely where it has device characteristics for devices, so I can just add a new property to that dictionary or something.
Super easy, right?
Yeah.
So now I would love to dive deeper into kind of the technical aspect of this, which Apple has a framework for reading game controller input. I believe it's even called the game controller framework, if I'm not mistaken, where you can get like a more higher level description of these controllers. Because like you mentioned, they all kind of work similarly in that they have some kind of home button, like the PlayStation button or the Xbox button or the home button on the Nintendo Switch. They have different kind of face buttons. They have dual analog sticks and so on and so forth. So they have very, very similar layouts, but they are all slightly different, right? Like what gets me every time I switch between the Xbox and the Switch, for example, is that the A and B buttons are switched. So, you know, they are in different places. So that always gets me when I need to press the A button. So there is kind of a higher level framework for interacting with them when you're building an actual app or a game and you want to integrate game controller support. But in your case, like you were talking about, you wanted to add other features. You're not actually looking for someone to control AirBuddy with a game controller here. So you're not really reading the inputs, but instead you want to read the battery levels and show like device information. So what was involved in making that happen? Because I assume it wasn't as easy as just importing a framework from Apple and just, you know, building the UI.
Yeah, the thing is, I had tested game controllers back when I was initially doing the integration for third-party headsets, which was my idea when Apple added support for those. So I decided, hey, maybe I'll check out if they also do game controllers. So I paired, I think at the time it was the DualShock controller, so the PS4 one, paired it with my Mac and opened the Bluetooth menu, and it wouldn't show battery information. So I was like, okay, never mind. And then like a while later, oh, let me test that again. And then I connected and it did show the battery in the Bluetooth menu from Apple. So it showed the battery for my DualShock controller. So I was like, hey, I can now use this, because that's the same information that AirBuddy gets, basically, because they use a similar API under the hood. So I went into the app, I don't remember, but I removed whatever check it was doing for like not including those devices. And then and by the time I was finished with this little test implementation in the app, the controller had turned off because it sleeps after a while and disconnects. So I connected it again, and then it wouldn't show the battery level. macOS wasn't showing the battery level.
So it's very funny because I've had the exact same experience, like with the exact same controller, because I was playing some Apple Arcade games and I wanted to use my PlayStation 4 controller for that. And it had ran out of battery or something. So I went to check the battery level. I was charging it for a bit and then it was showing it. And I was like, oh, this is new. This is fantastic. Like in the native UI. And then the next time I tried it, it also didn't show. So I had the exact same experience. It seems kind of flaky, this information.
Yeah, exactly. And as I went again into this issue now, I learned that the reason is that most of these controllers, when they first boot up and they connect to a device, they are in a given mode. So they are not reporting their battery level when they are in that mode. So basically, the host device has to send them a command to tell them, hey, please start reporting your full thing with the battery level and things like that. It's the same thing for like, if you want accelerometer data from most of these controllers have accelerometers. So if you want that data, you also have to tell the controller, hey, please start giving me accelerometer data. And this is all for power saving, of course, because
right.
If the host doesn't need certain bits of information, then the controller just won't send it. And for some reason, sometimes macOS puts the controllers in that state and sometimes it doesn't. Although for some of them, like for the Joy-Con controllers, I haven't seen macOS report battery level for them like ever. So I don't think they support it for those. But yeah, so I decided to look into what would it take for me to do that support in AirBuddy and actually talk the protocol of the given controller that I'm wanting to talk with. And one thing that really helped was the fact that the gamer community is so passionate and there are so many developers who are also gamers. So you can go on GitHub, and this is something I do quite a bit. I don't think people realize how powerful the search engine is on GitHub, but even sometimes like I'm trying to use a more obscure API or something. It's sometimes even like a private API or something like that. You can go on GitHub and you can search like paste like the function name and then do :\Swift or :\M to search for Swift or Objective-C files, and you'll search all of GitHub for code that calls that thing you're trying to learn about. So this is just an example, but then I basically went on GitHub and searched for like PlayStation DualSense Nintendo Joy-Con and things like that. And I found lots of projects that have reverse engineered the protocols that these controllers talk. So I basically didn't have to do as much reverse engineering myself which was definitely handy because as you know from my experience with AirPods, I've spent several hours of reverse engineering to learn about the protocol and implement it in AirBuddy because there wasn't as much information readily available. But fortunately for these game controllers, there's a lot of stuff available about them.
Yeah, I think saying several hours is a bit of an understatement. I think, you know, from talking to you and hearing about your journey spelunking these things and figuring them out, like, I think we're talking about days and weeks, right? Like, not just, oh, it was just a few hours of work. Because you have to, like, look at the actual bits that they're sending, right? The actual binary data and figure out, like, what each one means.
Yeah, exactly. I meant, like, if you sum up all the hours, but yeah, probably hundreds of hours if you count everything. But yeah, and it's tricky because you might think, well, I will just look at the stream of bytes that's coming from the device, and I will look at what the battery level is from a known good source, and then I can basically do a search for like the hexadecimal value. But it doesn't work like that because many times these protocols use bit masks, and the hexadecimal value you see is actually the battery level combined with a mask with some bits to indicate other state, because they can fit all of that in a single byte. So it's not that easy. And also, what makes it even more complicated is that sometimes, at least I think most times, these devices, it's kind of like when they're connected over Bluetooth to the Mac, they're one device. But when they're connected over USB, it's like they're a completely different device. And that makes things way more complicated.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because even as a gamer, like using these controllers, like the feature set that you get is different if you have a wired connection versus a Bluetooth connection, versus some controllers, like for example, the Xbox controller also supports connecting over a proprietary network connection, which requires an adapter. So yeah. Then you get different feature set. Like for example, with a DualSense, I think you don't get that adaptive triggers that the PlayStation 5 has when you're using a Bluetooth connection. You have to have a wired connection for that.
Oh, you can. You can actually do that with Bluetooth.
Oh, that's interesting. But yeah. Is that something that happens automatically? Because when I was investigating this for my own needs, because I was thinking about getting a DualSense for my gaming PC just to play like PlayStation-based games that are ported to PC with a DualSense controller, but it seemed to me that I would need to connect it with a Bluetooth cable in order to get like that full experience. But maybe that's not true.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the drivers for the platform, but anyone can write a custom driver, because I know that it does support that, because I actually got a really good app on the Mac App Store. It's called, I think, DualSense M, and it's an app that lets you play around with all of the features of the DualSense when it's connected to the Mac, and you can set the adaptive trigger modes using that app when the controller is connected over Bluetooth. So the controller definitely supports it, but I guess it will depend on the drivers for Windows or the specific game you're using.
Right. I think it comes down to what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, the controllers are waiting for this command to activate certain features for power saving reasons. Yeah. So perhaps I just need some kind of plugin or driver. Oh, with Windows, it always comes down to drivers, doesn't it? But yeah. I probably need some kind of system, some kind of plugin or app or something to activate that feature of the DualSense. But yeah, if that's possible, that's actually very, very interesting for me. Just as a little sidetrack here. But yeah, I know from experience, like what you were talking about just before, that the controllers behave differently when wired versus when they are in wireless mode.
Yeah, definitely. And now that I'm working with the Joy-Cons, I'm having ideas. Like, for example, when you use your AirPods, the app does that grouping of the AirPods and the charging case. And if both AirPods have the same battery state, it will show them as one thing. And I'm thinking, should I do that for the Joy-Con? Maybe it would be fun. Like when it's in the little adapter that you can... What is that called? Like the thing that makes the controller look like a puppy?
I don't know. It's definitely not called a puppy as far as I know. But, you know, it's probably just like the Joy-Con holder or something. The one which makes them act as one controller instead of being two separate units.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, so can I detect that state? Can I show them group? That would be kind of cute. But yeah, we'll think about it. I can call it puppy mode if I want to.
That sounds great. I mean, the Switch can definitely detect that, right? Because it does show up on the Switch as one controller, then it behaves very differently. So maybe you need to do some spelunking there to figure out what the exact bitmask data is that tells it that it's in this puppy mode.
Yeah, and specifically about the technical details, one of the reasons why I hadn't looked into this too much before was that I was under the impression that I wouldn't be able to do this sort of communication with the devices on user mode, so without actually writing an extension, like a kernel extension or like a driver kit extension. So I thought that would be required in order for me to do this sort of communication that I'm doing. But turns out I hadn't looked deep enough and carefully enough, and you can totally talk to human interface devices from user space, so from an app on macOS, and I just hadn't looked deep enough.
And this kind of information, like the battery information and the connection information that you're interested in, it doesn't require you to register as reading input from the controller, right? Because I'm assuming that when the controller is actually being used to play a game, for example, it's sending data way more frequently. And when it's sending these kinds of pings or whatever you want to call them that are reporting this kind of information like battery levels, that's like a separate thing from the actual game input, right?
Yeah, the system will multiplex that for you. That's the good thing about having an operating system, right?
Right.
So there is like a little flag in the... So for those who want to look into this, it's IOKit and the IOHID API. So IOHID manager and IOHID device. There is a flag when you open... I don't remember if it's the device itself, but you can basically tell it, give me exclusive control of this device. I assume that if I would do that, then it would basically render the controller unusable for the rest of the operating system. But of course, I'm not doing that because that's not my goal. But I also assume that if some other process on the system does that, then I will lose access to that controller information. But in my testing here, and I've only tested with some Apple Arcade games that support game controllers, but the two things don't seem to interfere with each other, because like most things AirBuddy does, this is mostly passive. So the only thing that's active about it is on initial connection, it performs whatever write it has to perform for that handshake so that the controller starts reporting the battery information. But after that, it's passive. It just gets notified about the HID reports and then grabs the info from there. So from my testing, it doesn't interfere with anything, and it definitely shouldn't.
All right, that's great to hear then. So this sounds like a really, really exciting project. I'm definitely very keen to try this out myself, because I haven't really been playing a lot of Apple Arcade games recently, to be honest, but from time to time, I like to check out some games, and it's really cool also that you can now, with the MacBook Pros that we both have, they have HDMI output, so you can very easily just like connect it to your TV and play like as if it was a console if you connect a controller to it. So that experience, this will probably improve quite a bit, that you will be able to have that much easier integration with game controllers thanks to AirBuddy.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So that was a really, really interesting little mini deep dive there into the work you've been doing around game controllers, which I think perfectly kind of intersects both of our interests, right? Like your Bluetooth interest and my gaming interest. So a very, very cool topic. But now let's move on to the next topic of the show, which will be what I've been up to. But before we do, let's take a very quick break here to thank this episode's sponsor. This episode of Stack Trace is sponsored by NordVPN. Go to nordvpn.com/stacktrace to find out much more about their fast, secure, and private VPN service, and to get a special deal on your subscription while also supporting this podcast in the process. NordVPN is the VPN service that I personally use whenever I need a VPN. For example, when I'm traveling, when I need to connect to a Wi-Fi network that I don't quite trust, or when I want to access resources that are, for example, only available in Sweden while I'm here in Poland. Now, there are of course many VPN services out there, so why should you choose NordVPN? Well, first of all, their core VPN experience is really great. It's super fast, you can connect up to 6 different devices all at once on a single account, you have thousands of servers to pick from around the world, it's very, very easy to use, and it works across platforms including iOS, macOS, Android, and Windows. Plus, their service is completely diskless, so that your data is never stored on-site on NordVPN servers, which is great in terms of security and privacy. And on top of all that, you also get additional features included with your NordVPN subscription, such as threat protection, which blocks trackers, intrusive ads, and online malware. So check out NordVPN today by going to nordvpn.com/stacktrace. Using that link directly supports mine and Rambo's work with Stacktrace. So if you're interested in learning more about NordVPN, then please use that link to support the show. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/stacktrace. Thanks so much to NordVPN for sponsoring this episode.
So John, what have you been up to?
So a bunch of different things. I'm continuing to work a lot with the Swift UI, of course, and work on my various client projects, which are now, I would say pretty much all of them are actually adopting Swift UI to different degrees now, which is really, really exciting. And it's been also interesting to work on some projects that were kind of built from the ground up with Swift UI in mind. I don't have any projects that are quote unquote pure Swift UI or 100% Swift UI, because like we've discussed a lot of times in the past, I really like to mix UIKit with Swift UI. But it's also been really interesting now recently to work on projects that are primarily UIKit based, but are now introducing Swift UI for certain features. And that is also kind of, you know, forced me to think about the framework and interoperability between UIKit and SwiftUI in different ways, and how to kind of make data that existed for a long time work well with the framework and so on. So I do have some things to talk about regarding that this week. But I also did something really fun, which was to run a brand new workshop for the first time the other week, which is also SwiftUI themed. It's called Advanced SwiftUI. And it's a kind of follow-up to my pretty popular Swift UI course that I've been doing for a few years now, which is a 2-day workshop where I talk about kind of the fundamentals of Swift UI and show the attendees how to use like the built-in components and the layout system, the state management system, and so on. UIKit, Swift UI interoperability is an important topic, of course. But this course is a 1-day workshop, which was very much designed to be kind of a follow-up to that one. So talking more about more advanced topics like dependency management and passing data and working around certain kind of quirks of the framework, if you will, like how to make sure your objects don't get deallocated in the middle of a view lifecycle, and how to really kind of use the layout system in a good way, and so on and so forth. So that's a workshop I've been working on for several months now, actually like building it like a brand new set of materials and working on that and building it and making sure it's really polished and works well in a workshop context. And yeah, just had the premiere the other week and it went really, really well, I must say. I had a lot of fun, and now there are also tickets available if someone who is out there listening to the show wants to sign up for the next edition of the workshop. It's also available online now, and we will leave a link in the show notes for that. So yeah, that's been a really, really fun project to work on. Hello, this is John from the future. So I just realized that I should probably emphasize that this workshop takes place in the Central European time zone. So it's probably the most practical for people who are in Europe or in similar time zone to attend this edition. We will definitely work on bringing this workshop to different time zones in the future, or do something different in terms of scheduling so that other people from around the world can attend. I just wanted to emphasize this here before anyone buys tickets, so that you know, because we know that we have a very international audience here from all around the world, which is really, really wonderful, and we love that. But workshops is sometimes tricky when you're doing them in real time, that they do have to happen in a time zone, because that's actually a thing, right? So just wanted to emphasize this, and now back to the show.
Yeah, that's awesome. I miss doing some workshops, and especially I miss doing in-person stuff. Now that I have traveled internationally again, I am feeling adventurous, so maybe I'll be going to some conferences this year. We'll see. But yeah, it's always fun, and I'm always curious when you do these and things evolve and people learn more about the technology and get more experience. What would you say are like the top things people get confused about these days when it comes to SwiftUI or the more advanced parts of SwiftUI?
So I think it all comes down to the trap that you can fall into with SwiftUI, which is that in the beginning or when you're starting out with a new view or a new feature, everything seems so simple with SwiftUI, right? I mean, we're now talking about when you've learned the basics of the framework and you've kind of gotten used to it. Because of course, in the beginning, it can be very confusing, or especially if you're coming from UIKit, which is another thing that is often confusing to people, like still thinking in terms of UIKit, but now working with SwiftUI, right? And kind of bringing over a lot of those patterns and thinking in terms of, you know, delegate protocols and subclassing and things like that that don't exist in the world of SwiftUI really, and view controllers also. So that's one thing. But now then that people have gotten more used to it, like you said, at least many developers have, and especially the developers attending this kind of more advanced course, the kind of trap then is that in the beginning it can seem so simple, but then you end up having to do workarounds and you discover things and kind of behaviors of SwiftUI that you don't quite want and you want to customize it. And that's where it can be really, really difficult and kind of you can struggle a little bit to figure out what is a good way forward here. And that's really kind of what I wanted to do during this workshop, is to show a lot of these different techniques that I've developed myself and you know, talked to other people in the community and kind of seen what people in general are struggling with sometimes when working with SwiftUI. And this is not only something that I am doing a workshop on, I'm also writing articles about it. In fact, I published an article the other week about how the content offset of a SwiftUI scroll view can be observed using SwiftUI itself, not bridging to UIKit. So there are different techniques I'm working on and I've been using myself in production for a while that I just want to share with people in different contexts and talk about. And yeah, it seems like in general, that's the theme. It's that, you know, you can feel like you hit a brick wall with SwiftUI sometimes where it doesn't quite do what you want and you're not quite sure how to proceed. And that's kind of, I want to try to share my general thinking of how I'm kind of developing these, not necessarily workarounds always, but ways to customize the framework.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And as you get more advanced, you will want to customize more things, and knowing how to do that and knowing how you can sometimes not customize things, but create your own. Because I think there are many times when you get to a certain level of customization where it's better to create your own version of something rather than try to shoehorn the built-in thing to do what you want. And one of the things that always scares people about that, or at least should, especially in AppKit and UIKit, is things like accessibility, right? Because you get a lot of that for free with built-in controls. But with SwiftUI, you get accessibility representation, which is just fantastic. So you can make your own whatever button, not a button, because buttons are very customizable in SwiftUI, but just as an example, you can make your own completely custom thing that looks like a button and then add an accessibility representation as a button to it. And for things like VoiceOver, it looks like a button. Of course, you still have to take care of a lot of other things if you are doing your own custom, completely custom UI for certain controls. But in general, I think finding that breaking point where you should give up on trying to force the built-in thing to do what you want and approach it in a completely custom way is something you learn as you get more experience with SwiftUI.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And also, like, related to things like accessibility and other kinds of features that you definitely want to add if you build a custom component, like, that's aspects of SwiftUI that I feel like are very, very rich. Like, they offer a lot of APIs there. Like, if you type dot accessibility and you see all the modifiers that are available for accessibility in SwiftUI, there's a lot. So that is all kind of there. And the same thing goes with the state management system. Like, one question I often get during these workshops is like, you know, how stable was the SwiftUI state management system in the early releases of the framework? And with the notable exception of state object, which was introduced in iOS 14, I will say that the state management system was pretty rock solid since the beginning, right? And with iOS 14, which a lot of teams can now use as their minimum deployment target, given that we're on iOS 16 at the moment, then you have state object and you have all those tools available. And that I feel like also opens up so much customization when we're talking about, you know, how you can pass your data around and how you can make your existing data models work well with SwiftUI and how you can implement different kinds of architectural styles and different ways of delegating events across views and so on with those tools available. So when I'm talking about customization, I'm not just talking about like customizing a view to look exactly like you want. That's of course an important aspect too, but also how can you make SwiftUI work for the type of data and the type of features that you actually want to build?
Yeah, definitely. And what else is going on in your SwiftUI corner these days?
Yeah, we are always ending up there one way or another, right? Either through me or through you. Like, we're always falling back into the SwiftUI corner. But, you know, it's on our minds a lot these days. And I think there's also so many learnings to be had re-examining some certain patterns and things like that as you move on to working with SwiftUI. And that has definitely happened to me when it comes to view models in particular, where I've been a pretty big fan of view models for a while. Like, I've used them in so many different projects, both big and small. And I think that the kind of problems that they solve are, you know, there's a good solution to those types of problems, which is usually in UIKit, where you might have a complex view controller that you want to delegate some of the logic that is view related onto some other object. You don't want to implement it in your actual view controller. You want to have some separate object that you control, that you can unit test more easily, and it acts as the kind of bridge between your data layer and your view layer. And that's where view models really, really shine, I feel like. And then when you go to SwiftUI and you don't have view controllers anymore, you just have views, then view models can act in a similar role, but slightly different, where they provide you with this more kind of object-oriented way of coding in a declarative world, right?
Yeah.
Where if you implement your own view model or observable object, that's a class that you control completely, and you can write whatever code you want in there. You can use whatever kind of abstractions you want, whatever protocols you want, and so on and so forth, while in the world of SwiftUI, you are more limited to how you can actually like define your views and how you can pass data and state between them, because that's where SwiftUI state management system really has a strong opinion about, you know, what tools are available there. So I feel like it kind of both acts as a nice escape hatch into the world of object-oriented programming when you need it. But also similar to in UIKit, if you have a view that has a lot of complicated behaviors, a view model can be a great way to kind of offload some of that complexity into another object as to not make your view too complicated. So both in SwiftUI and in UIKit, I'm a big fan of using view models, but recently I found myself kind of thinking about to what extent I want to use view models, and do I fully want to like go for like MVVM as my actual architecture, like model view view model, or what kind of relationship do I feel like I want to have to the view models I write? But before I get too deep into that, I just want to ask you, Rambo, like, how do you feel around this topic? Like, do you, I feel like you also use view models quite a bit, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been moving back and forth, and I feel like that's the conversation we're about to have. And maybe you found some other solution or pattern that works for you. But I see myself using different approaches when it comes to SwiftUI. And I haven't been calling these objects view models as much anymore. They are usually something controller, because I feel like controller is more in line with what they actually do. Because if we want to compare it to UIKit or AppKit, the way I see them is kind of like view controllers in a sense, but without the view part. So they don't take care of any UI thing necessarily, not directly, and they provide the business logic for the view. And yeah, I've been going back and forth on this. Something I've been trying to avoid, and people might hear this, especially beginners, and think, oh, Rambo said not to use this, so I won't use it. Keep in mind there's important aspects to this, but something I've been avoiding is environment object, but not in the sense of dependency injection, because I feel like environment object is fantastic for dependency injection when you need a particular parent object that all of a subtree is going to need some aspect of it. but I have been avoiding it as a state providing kind of object. So if I need something like in the environment to provide some service or some method that I need to call from various places, I will use environment object. I'll avoid using environment objects that have a bunch of at published properties. And that's both for sanity reasons, so that I understand everything that's happening as much as possible, but also for performance reasons, because anything that's invalidated in your environment object will invalidate those views as well. And sometimes that might be unexpected, and you might end up in situations where you are having way more things invalidated when they shouldn't, because you have a heavy environment object that's being invalidated all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very interesting to hear you say this, because this is exactly the line of thinking I've been on for a while now. And I think what I've realized, or what I've come to the conclusion, is that in an ideal world, and we're always, when we're talking about app architecture and stuff, we're often talking about ideal worlds, right? Because you have to make these pragmatic decisions always on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, especially when you're working in an existing code base, perhaps, that you're developing new features for, you can't always use your dream architecture, right? Like, sometimes you just have to adapt what is already there to keep things fairly consistent and so on and so forth, right? But I think my preference these days is that I really want to decouple state management from logic or performing work. So if I have something like a view model, and the reason I implemented the view model was to manage the state for a view, and I don't want to just keep all the state in the view for some reason, perhaps because the state itself is kind of complicated and I feel like I want to extract that to a separate object where I can unit test it, for example, or there are some complex interactions that need to happen with that state and I want to have things like validation and maybe, you know, delegate into some other objects and so on, and that I want to also be able to test or implement in a way that is not just in the view, because the view has to do so many other things regarding, you know, handling input and doing layout and so on. And I feel like mixing all those things together, well, you kind of end up in the massive view controller problem again, but now in a massive SwiftUI view, right? So separation of concerns, usually a good thing. And in this case, like, so if I have a view model like this, which has all that work to do regarding the actual state management, I don't also want it to perform the actual work related to loading and updating that state. So as an example, if you have a view that needs, for example, to, when it loads, when it first is appearing on screen, it needs to fetch some data from the network, then it has to decode that, it has to adapt it to a way that the view can render, and it has to give it to the view. And then when the user performs various actions, it needs to then call back to the server to say, like, this item was deleted or this item was updated and so on. Like, handling the items and the interaction with the items, that's what I want the view model to do. But then the actual updating and networking, I don't want the view model to do, because that way I can decouple performing that work from the actual state management. And I found if I do that, and if I implement something more like, you know, different services or different controllers, like you said, that do the actual like work for the view, then the view model can become very focused and it's easy for me to answer the question of, where does this particular logic or this particular piece of code go? Well, if it's related to the layout and the input handling, it goes into the view. If it's related to the state management, it goes into the view model. And if it's related to something else, like actual logic and actual work that needs to be done, it goes somewhere else, like to some kind of external service or controller that gets dependency injected into the view model. And I found that if I follow that approach, I know this is kind of, you know, just classic kind of MVC in a way, right? But if I follow that approach and I separate those concerns like that, I found that to work really, really well. And I find that I get less into the problem of ending up with large view models. I end up with more testable code. And I also feel like it works really neatly in terms of kind of a scalable architecture that I can use across different projects.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, and it is definitely something that I try to do myself as well.
Great, but there's one caveat to this, though. So that is that, of course. So one thing that I've never been a fan of, and this goes back to, you know, the architectures that are more following kind of the clean architecture, as it's called, approach, where you have all these different layers. Like, I've never been a fan of adding layers for the sake of it. And I've never really felt like the consistency you get from having every single feature follow having the exact same amount of layers and the same letter combination, to actually really be worth it, at least not for most of the projects I worked on. And, you know, this is comes down to personal preference. I'm not saying it's wrong to, you know, have every single view have a view model, for example, for consistency. But personally, I always kind of want to be very pragmatic about these things. And depending on the view I'm building, I want to you just implement the things that are needed for that particular view. So as an example, if I'm building something where I have a view that only needs to like load some data from somewhere and then needs to perform an action on the data. Let's say that you can view an item that you can load and then you can mark the item as a favorite or not. Then the question is, do I really need a view model for that? Because if I already have these services and then the view really just needs to render and then pass an action that is an asynchronous action back to, for example, the parent, then adding an extra view model there, adding an extra like observable object and doing all that dependency injection and wiring up those different layers, it feels like a lot of work just for those simple things. And I've written a lot of different articles about this approach in general on Swift by Sundell. But what I really like to do these days, and I've been a fan of this for a while now, is to, when I just need to do something simple, is to, instead of injecting this big object that has to implement all these different things, to instead just implement a function and inject a asynchronous function into even the view. So for example, in this case, I could inject one function that is called load item and another function that is called toggle favorite for item. And those would both be async functions. And thanks to async await and the task modifier, for example, in SwiftUI, that's really, really easy to implement then on the view layer. The view just needs to call like one different thing to actually load the data. And then I am using an abstraction I built, which is also, I've written an article on how I built that, which is called async button, where I have a button that can just perform an asynchronous action and it performs, it like shows a loading spinner while it's doing it and so on. And then I can just add an async button into my view that then calls that toggle favorite function asynchronously with async await. And then all of a sudden I have this view that used to be very complex. It needed to have like a view model and services and all sorts of things. And now all of a sudden it just shows the UI and has two functions and it's becomes relatively simple. Like this quite complex data flow becomes pretty simple to implement. And that I've also found to be incredibly useful to not always go for a view model for every single view, but sometimes say, you know what, here I just need a function and that's enough. And then that could be wired up to like a parent view model or a service at in the parent view. And that also works really well in a more kind of lightweight way.
Yeah, that's really nice. And you also avoid unnecessary state, right? Because you are not injecting a full-blown view model or some other type of object that probably has state either internal or external that the view doesn't care about. And if the view only cares about those little async calls that it has to make, then there's no sense in injecting the full object in there. I guess if you had more than like a couple or a few async calls, it would get a little bit weird, but you could maybe inject something that implements a protocol. Who knows? And yeah, I really like that approach. I think I'm going to start doing it more. I have done it in some of my projects. I do have an async button as well. I think most SwiftUI projects will end up having some sort of async button at some point. And yeah, I think you avoid a bunch of problems that way. And it doesn't really affect your ability to test things or anything like that.
In fact, it makes it even better, for example, in the case of previews, where one of the absolutely best aspects of async await is that any async function can also be a synchronous function, right?
Yeah.
So in your unit test, for example, you can just return your mocks and your data stubs directly synchronously instead of having to do some kind of wrapper. Like if you're using combine, you have to use the just publisher to return a single value, right? Because it's all integrated into the language, you can just return the value you want. And in previews, instead of having to inject like a mocked version of your view model or observable object that has all these, you know, mock network things and everything that you need to implement, not in your unit test code base, but in your actual code base, if you want to use previews, now all of a sudden you can just return the data model you want to show in your view synchronously in your previews as just a single value, and it just works, right?
Yeah.
So that is also a huge benefit, I feel like, with this kind of pattern.
Yeah, I make a distinction in my brain of two, maybe there are more, but at least like two different types of SwiftUI views. I think maybe I talked about this before, but there are rendering views and there are like views that are more like what a view controller would be on UIKit. So if you think about what I'm calling a rendering view, all it does is display some state and that's it. So that might be like you inject a model in the initializer and just like renders whatever it has to render for that model. And there are other views where when it shows up, it'll run an asynchronous task and load something and then populate the contents. And I like to keep that distinction in mind. Sometimes I hope that distinction actually existed in the types to make things more clear and harder to get wrong. But I'm curious if you also feel this way about there are two different types of SwiftUI views. And if you take that approach, I thought about it because you mentioned previews. And the way I approach previews, at least the way I try to approach previews, is to preview whatever what I'm calling the render view is, not the view that's actually initializing things and doing calls and things like that. So if I'm trying to write a preview for a view and it's getting too complicated because I'm not doing the really nice injecting async closures thing you're talking about, maybe I'll start doing that. But if it's getting too complicated, I'll probably get whatever the core rendering of that view is and extract it to another view type that only takes the model as an input, and that's it. And it makes it easier for previews.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do the same thing. And in fact, in most of the projects I work on, I even split up what I call screens and views. So for example, what used to be like a top-level view controller in your navigation stack now becomes a screen. So I even call it that. Like I call it, for example, profile screen or...
Oh, I love that. I'm definitely stealing that.
Cool. I mean, it's one of those things where do you really want the view to be aware that it's shown like as a full screen kind of thing? And, you know, if it is on iPad or something, perhaps it's not technically full screen. Perhaps it's in this... more like split view as an example or something else. But it's good enough, I feel like, this naming. Naming is always hard, but it says what I wanted to say, which is this is like a destination in the app. This is something you can navigate to. This is a screen of the app. And I feel like it kind of fulfills, that naming convention fulfills a similar benefit that something like storyboards used to fulfill, where you could easily get an overview of the app and the navigation flow if I keep all of my screens in a folder in my Xcode project. And, you know, they might have subfolders and so on, depending on the scale of the project. But if there's a place to go in the project where I can see all the screens, that makes it so much easier to get an overview of the code base. And then to your point, those screens then have rendering views. So they have actual views that have used the view suffix in the name that do the actual rendering. And the general rule of thumb for me is that my observable objects, my environment objects and so on, they are in the screen types and not in the view types. There are certain more complex views that are kind of sub-screens, if you will, but they are sometimes also having view models and things depending on the needs. But in general, I want to keep them as simple as possible for the reasons we just discussed. So that distinction works really well for me.
Yeah, nice. I'm definitely going to start using the screen name more because it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think like for me, like when I implement a view model these days, I prefer it to kind of just be a state management tool, like kind of like a data transformation engine, which just transforms the data from the services or the controllers it loads it from or communicates with and then shows it in the UI. And to not just feel like I need to implement a view model for every view, but rather, you know, use it when I feel like it adds some value, with this abstraction adds some value. And I feel like if I take an approach like that, where I have my architectural toolbox, I have the things that I am allowed to use, if you will, in the project, but it doesn't mean that I have to use all of them for every single feature, that creates like a truly scalable approach, I feel like, where some screens will be simpler, they have a simpler implementation, they don't implement objects just to satisfy some specific architecture pattern, but at the same time, it's a well-known pattern that I can... you know, I and other people on the team can use when needed across different views without it becoming like super inconsistent. So yeah, I feel like that approach in general works well, regardless if you're using SwiftUI or UIKit when you're kind of designing an architecture, to create like a nice toolbox of abstractions and tools you can use, but not necessarily enforce that they should all be used inside of every single feature.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Cool. So Swift UI will definitely be something we will revisit, of course, because we do have our Swift UI corner. And app architecture as well is like one of those evergreen topics, right? We just talk about talk about it all the time because, you know, I always keep going back and forth and I'm always thinking about, you know, what are some of the different trade-offs between each different solution and also about like taste and trends, right? Like sometimes something becomes more popular and then it kind of fades away and then it comes back. And yeah, that's just kind of the way it is. Our app architecture and code is more kind of fashion driven than I think sometimes we like to admit, right?
Absolutely. Very much fashion driven.
Absolutely. All right. So that's it for this episode of Stacktrace. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you again on the next episode. Thanks also so much to NordVPN for sponsoring this episode. You can check them out at nordvpn.com/stacktrace to help support our podcast. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for you to say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.
All right, Rambo. So now I would love to hear about your trip to Europe, because even though I am a little bit sad that you didn't visit me while you were in my part of the world, I do understand because you did have a very, very packed agenda. You were doing a lot of different visits to different cities across Europe. So tell me all about it.
Yeah, definitely. So we were on the same time zone, which was interesting. Like, I think my first text to you from Barcelona was, "We're on the same time zone. Yay."
Yeah, you didn't have to wait for hours until I respond and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. I guess it's usually you who's waiting for me because you wake up before me. And then at night, I know that like after like 6, 7 p.m. my time, if I message you, I'll probably only get a response the next day, which is perfectly acceptable because it's way later for you. So yeah, it was fun. And like you mentioned, I was traveling with my boyfriend and his family. So we had a very packed schedule. So I wouldn't really have been able to travel to Poland this time, although I definitely want to at some point. And I wish you can come to Brazil as well at some
point. Yeah,
absolutely. But I know you're not in a position to travel very much as it stands, right? Lots of responsibilities. So it'll probably take a few years, right?
Maybe not years. I mean, I want to be optimistic. And I also want to travel with our son as well. Like maybe not to Brazil the first trip, but we are planning some shorter trips here in Europe to visit some different countries just to, you know, start traveling with him and get used to it. Because I don't want to be a person who is just kind of locked at home for, you know, 18 years until my son moves away from home, which I definitely don't think is necessary. So we will travel and maybe, you know, make my way to Brazil. Maybe not, you know, with the whole family the first time. Maybe I'll go by myself, but I don't think you will have to wait years. Not years in plural, maybe year or two, but we'll definitely see each other in Brazil soon, I hope.
Yeah, if you want to fly to where I live in Brazil, you'd probably have to take 1, 2, 3 flights, right? Because I don't think there are any direct flights from Poland to Brazil. I don't think so.
No, I haven't looked into it recently. I mean, there was the time where we were planning for me to come visit you to speak at a conference, but then unfortunately the pandemic started and all that, all those things. But yeah, I definitely want to visit, not necessarily to speak at a conference, but just to visit you and just to see the country because, you know, it seems like such an amazing place. So definitely want to visit it eventually.
Well, at least if you come to speak at NS Brazil, it's in São Paulo, so it's not going to be 3 flights. Probably going to be just 2. One from Poland to some hub somewhere, maybe Italy or France, I don't know, and then to São Paulo. And then you stay a few days at the conference, and then you can fly here. Then it's like a 1-hour flight. It's fine. But yeah, I'm talking about the flights because, wow, Europe is far, John.
Yeah, it turns out crossing the Atlantic takes a while, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I was not used to it anymore because it had been like 3 years since my last international trip, which was to Paris back then. It was a lot of fun. I think it was for .Swift, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's 11 hours, I think, from São Paulo to Barcelona. I don't even count the flight from here to São Paulo, because that's not even an appetizer. So, and then we spent a few days in Barcelona. I really liked it. I had never visited Barcelona, just Madrid and Logroño because of NS Spain.
Yeah, so we were there together.
Yeah, definitely. So it was fun to visit and get to know the city. There's lots of really nice places to visit there. We were in a hotel fairly close to the Sagrada Familia, which is just breathtaking. Like, it's amazing. Even if you're not like religious at all, it's just like a fantastic feat of engineering and architecture. I really loved it. And I took many pictures and also just stayed there staring at things because it's so amazing.
Yeah, I think that can be said for Barcelona in general, right? Like, it's such an amazing city in terms of architecture and also has such an incredible vibe, I feel like. Like, yep. I've been there a few times and every time I've had a really, really good time. Like, of course, doing some sightseeing and seeing all those different amazing places and buildings and architecture and the beach and so on, but also just like the atmosphere and the food and all those things. Like, being in Spain in general is always a good time for me. Like, I've always had a good time going there, but Barcelona in particular, I feel like is an amazing city.
Yeah, absolutely. Very dry air though during the time I was there, so keep that in mind if you're traveling to Barcelona and you have problems with lack of air humidity. So I suffered a little bit, so had to use lots of eye drops and drink a lot of water.
Yeah, and air quality in general, like, not just related to humidity, but air quality can be a problem sometimes in larger cities in Europe. And yeah, that's also something to keep an eye out for when you're planning your trip, because sometimes, you know, different cities have better or worse air quality in different parts of the year.
Yeah, we also went to Paris, which wasn't my first time in Paris, but last time since I was there for the conference mainly, we didn't get to see many interesting, like, touristy places. So yeah, we did all the touristy stuff in Paris. I think the highlight was definitely I was going to say climbing the Eiffel Tower, but that sounds way more exciting than just getting in an elevator. But the elevator is really interesting because it's old and different, and it kind of goes in a diagonal fashion, which is interesting. Unfortunately, we didn't get to go all the way up because they are doing some renovations or maintenance. So we only got to go to the second floor, but that's like already super high, and it was extremely cold for a Brazilian up there.
Yeah, it's funny because we definitely have different definitions of cold, right? For me, yeah, this is like normal weather, but for you, of course, it's very, very cold, like the winter temperatures in Paris. But the Eiffel Tower, like what you said, is I've never been up to it, actually, like only been underneath, like at the location. But the coolest thing I think about the Eiffel Tower is that it's so much larger, even if you've seen a lot of pictures of it. But when you see it in real life, like, it feels so much larger and more epic than a picture could ever show you. And the fact also that no matter pretty much where you are in Paris, you can always spot the Eiffel Tower. Like, it's a true landmark in that sense. It's also very practical when you're kind of navigating as a tourist, but also it's just so cool to always be able to see it on the horizon.
Yeah, and if you want to go up the Eiffel Tower, I definitely recommend it. There are lots of different... I think you can go for free, but then there might be a large queue, but you can pay it's not very much, and you get like a little bit faster access. And it didn't take us more than like an hour, maybe an hour and a half to... Like, between getting there, getting through security, going up, seeing what there is to see up there, and then going back down, it was fast. So even if you have like a day in Paris and you want to really do that, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm really hoping to go back to Paris soon because it's definitely one of my favorite places to go. That time I hope I will be able to get up and see the actual Eiffel Tower. Yeah. So that was destination number two, Paris, right?
Yeah. And we also went to Disneyland Paris, which was also fun.
Oh, nice. I've never been there. That seems also like a cool place.
It's really nice. But nothing against Barcelona or Paris. I love those places as well. But the best part of the trip definitely was Rome.
Nice. Yeah, can't go wrong with Italy, right? Like, that's another place we've been together. Like, we've been traveling quite a bit, you and me together, Rambo, when you've been over here in Europe. But we had a great time in Italy last time we were there. I've never been to Rome, but tell me about it. How was it?
Yeah, I think the best part is that I got an Airbnb right in front of the Colosseum. So when we opened up the bedroom window in the morning, the Colosseum was right there in front of us. And throughout, like, the whole apartment, all of the windows, you could see the Colosseum right in front of you. So that was really quite amazing to have that place and stay there, because we were right next to a lot of really cool places and really nice historical sites and things we could visit. And since it was already at the end of a two-week trip where we had been to two countries already, we were already quite a bit tired. So it was like taking a vacation from the vacation, in a sense. So it was much more relaxed, and we didn't have a very strict schedule other than a couple of tours we did. So we did like a full guided tour of the Colosseum and the Forum. And we also went to Pompeii and visited the Amalfi Coast. And that Pompeii is just, it's unexplainable. You have to go and see, like, you can see pictures, and it's just frozen in time. And it's kind of like you going through a time machine, in a sense.
Very cool. Yeah, definitely want to visit those places, because I've been a lot to northern Italy, but never to those parts. I've been to Sicily as well recently, actually, but not to kind of the middle part, if you will, or around Rome, like that kind of area. So definitely want to go there one day.
Yeah, and if you can get like a place in the historical part, or even like a place right in front of the Colosseum, of course it's going to be a bit pricey, but if it's just a few days, I definitely think it was worth it for that experience. And other than that, we ate a lot, like lots of pasta, pizza, and other goodies that Italy has to offer. My boyfriend really likes carbonara, and he had probably like all variants that you can have in a few days in Rome, and really loved it. We went to a really cool pizza place that does like the Roman style pizza, which I really love, and it was fantastic as well.
Nice. Did you pick up some inspiration also for your own cooking? Like, now that you're back home, are you kind of bringing the Italian kitchen back home with you?
Well, not only that, but I actually had a cooking class.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so this place we rented on Airbnb, they suggested to us, because they have they have like a bunch of different places, and they also have hotels, and there's a chef that works for them, and she offers these private cooking classes. So we had a class with her, and she taught us how to make gnocchi with sage and butter, and also the main course was fettuccine with tomato sauce. And also the chocolate salami, which is really interesting. And I think you hadn't seen it before, right? You found it a curious little thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm acting surprised here now that you took a cooking course, but of course you have shared these pictures with me here. So this is a little bit of podcasting magic here, right? But yeah, it looked super interesting. And also, like, all the dishes you showed me on the photos looked very, very delicious. And that's the one thing I really, really love about Italian cooking, like when I'm doing it myself, is that it feels like it's so much about the technique, like more than other cuisines, that you use a basic set of ingredients. And I don't mean to say like, oh, Italian food is basic, but, you know, the ingredients themselves are, you know, of course, important that you pick high quality ingredients. But then it so much comes down to how are you actually preparing these dishes and the techniques you use. And I feel like it's so interesting, because I can, now that I've been, you know, really interested in cooking for a few years, and I've been really trying to get better, especially at Italian food, making things like pasta and pizza, I can feel myself making much, much better foods with the same ingredients I was using a few years ago, but just because I have improved my technique, it gets better.
Yeah, so that's the thing. You mentioned like, it's simple, and that might sound like it's you're saying something bad about it, but that's not the case, because I am very much a fan of less is more when it comes to cooking. That when I cook, I like to make things with as few ingredients as possible, very straightforward. And I think that's the challenge, because if you are using lots of really fancy ingredients and stuff, there's a lot of opportunities for you to hide when things didn't go quite as planned or you didn't get the technique just right. But when all you have is like flour, water, salt, and tomato sauce, like and eggs, of course.
You also get an egg.
Yeah. Then you gotta get it right. Otherwise, right. There's no hiding that something went wrong. And definitely, I think you probably learned that making pizza. I definitely learned that making pizza and also making pasta at home, which I really love doing. I loved the technique because whenever I do gnocchi, I used to do it always with a potato base. And we did it with a ricotta. So I learned that. And now I see that it's way easier than the potato version. It's a lot easier and faster to work with. So I'm probably going to do that version a lot more at home. And I didn't feel like it misses too much from having the potato in there. So yeah, lots of little tidbits that I learned with the chef. And it's something I'm probably going to be doing more in future trips, like hire like someone to have a cooking class, because you always learn something. And of course, we got to eat all of that as well, which was fun.
Yeah, because I think we both agree that, you know, a big part of going somewhere on a trip is experiencing the food, right? Like, yep. The food is such a big part of the culture of a given country or region or location that, you know, this is such a big part of the experience. And then learning and bringing that home, like, that is kind of extends that trip with you. Like, for example, a few number of years ago, I went to Japan, and there I got to observe a chef making tonkatsu, which is like this pork cutlet made in a Japanese style. And now I very often make it at home, and I perhaps cannot make it as well as he was making it because it wasn't a cooking class. I was more like, it was one of those open kitchens, and I was just really keenly observing what he was doing. And my friends who speak Japanese were asking some questions and kind of figuring out how this dish was made in this kind of traditional way.
You were spelunking the tonkatsu.
Exactly. And now then when I can make it at home, I'm always thinking about that trip and that cool experience I had there in this tiny little restaurant. And, you know, people also who get to taste it, they always get surprised at how it tastes and that it's so cool to be able to eat this dish that is not, you know, very common over here. So, yeah, I am a huge fan of learning and picking up techniques of cooking when I'm traveling as well. Not just eating the food, but also trying to learn how to make it.
Yeah, definitely. So all in all, it was great fun, and it was very interesting to travel for the first time in a long time internationally, and also completely disconnected from work, because this was actual vacation, like absolutely zero connection to work whatsoever. I didn't even bring a laptop. The most quote advanced device I had was my iPad mini to like watch some YouTube videos, and that was it. So it was a lot of really decompressing and clearing the mind and resting from work, and I came back completely recharged. Let's see for how long the charge lasts. Let's see how often do I need to go to Europe to decompress.
Well, I hope it's going to be often, because, you know, then, you know, we can meet more often, right? So that would be super cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, glad you had a great trip. It seemed like it. And yeah, always great to have a nice vacation, right?
Absolutely.